Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. In this episode, we are talking about the top trade sales through Diamond to retailers in North America. This includes trades, hardcovers, omnibus, other collected editions, and frankly, whatever else they feel like putting on the list. We've actually got the top 500 this time. When we do month-to-month comparisons, we tend to limit that to the top 300 because we've got that going back further. But if you go all the way back to the beginning of the final order era, with Diamond, which was preceded by the pre-order era, where they just said, hey, this is what people want, versus switching to invoiced items in early 2003. Back then in early 2003, the list on trades was like 10 items long, then it got expanded to 25, then it got expanded to 50, then it got expanded to 300. Of late, it's been 500, but since we've got 300 going back further, I tend to use that for month-to-month comparisons. And it kind of gives, I don't say an even playing field against the comic side, but at least a similar-ish metric. Mm-hmm. If we look at the breakdown for December 2018, and yes, we're a little late getting to this set of data because I had stuff going on in my life and whatnot, but we're getting to it now. If we look at the breakdown of it, DC edged out Marvel in terms of number of units with 26.59% of the units for the top 300 trades versus Marvel's 25.6%. That's a difference of really about 2,114 units, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So they were ahead, but not, oh my god, they were ahead. We've had other months, particularly when Marvel's on top or whatever, just because they tend to put out more material, and frankly, they've got a, not necessarily a bigger fan base, although I kind of think they do, they've got a more active fan base that frankly just seems to buy a lot more than DC.
Mm-hmm.
So again, not that big of a difference between the two. If we look at it in terms of retail dollars, it actually flips with Marvel having more retail dollars at 23.03% of the total dollars for the top 300 trades, and DC having 30.32%. Again, not much of a gap. And that again, the number of units wasn't that different. The average price wasn't that different. I think Marvel's was, 54 cents more expensive on average than DC. So again, not that big of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
When we look at Image, they're clearly kind of that third place publisher in this respect in terms of Marvel and DC are gargantuan, you know, corporate subsidiaries and whatnot. Image, not so much, which I think is to its strength. They had 14.92% of the total units for the top 300 and 10.52% of the dollars for the top 300. And again, the lower percentage on the dollar side reflects a much lower average price, this time around $15.50 versus closing in on $30 for Marvel and DC. And mm-hmm. they did that with, let's see, 31,852 units compared to the roughly 55,000-ish for Marvel and DC.
Yeah. I would like to say, in regards to Image, that you are seeing some pricing pressure upwards, and it just may be the general inflation of the cost of making collected editions. You know, I've seen generally you would see the first book in a series. Now these are at the mainline Image. If you have a different contract with Shadowline or one of the other houses where right. they take a cut or they've given you a page rate, those books would often be $19.99 or some of their licensed stuff. But in general, you'd see $9.99 first issue trades of 4 to 6 issues. Then you'd see $14.99 to $16.99 for the second trades, depending on how many issues and if it was color or not. The outliers you would see were Walking Dead was always 6 issues, black and white, for $14.99. But that has changed. Now, also, the Walking Dead single issues have gone to $3.99, correct?
I believe so. I would have to double check. Give me just a second to go flip over to the Top comics tab, and Walking Dead is $3.99. You are correct.
Yeah. So I was wondering because I noticed that the Walking Dead trades are now $16.99, whereas they were $14.99, but they're still black and white. And I didn't know if that was Kirkman bowing to the realities of the, you know, just the general rise in price, right? Just inflationary pressure from everything getting more expensive, paper, ink, or the fact that he's, you know, one of the nice things that I think that's underrated about him is that because he's been so successful, if you look at the credits page on his books, he basically tries to create every possible job because he knows he's quite well off. And so he gives everyone a job. There's inkers, there's colorists, there's editors, there's layouts, you know what I mean? Like, whereas other Image books, sometimes they have to kind of jury rig it where the writer is also the letterer, you know, just to keep costs down. Whereas his, you know, he's obviously made quite a bit of money. So he has the money to be able to make sure everyone's getting, you know, everyone has a job, everyone's getting taken care of. And so I didn't know if the price increase was, you know, just the cost of making the actual product, or if it was, there's some actual, you know, labor costs that he's having to account for.
Well, I certainly don't think he's raising costs out of like a desperate need for money or something.
Oh, yeah.
But I've also got to wonder if creating those other jobs or having other people do those other jobs, let's phrase it that way, for letterer and colorist or, you know, whatever, is a matter to spread the work out to make sure he can meet the deadlines.
Yeah, that's also true. You know, obviously, a lot of the artists are their own inkers and whatnot, whereas, you know, in order to keep the book coming out on time, if you just, you know, obviously I'm sure he's paying the main artist a great page rate. And then having inkers and all that. So, yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to is he an inherently generous man or not. I don't know. I would like to think he is. Mm-hmm. But he's certainly a smart businessman. And given that way back around issues, you know, 40 or something, there was some scheduling issues and stuff like that, I think he's definitely learned some lessons on that. And doing what he can to make sure the book comes out on time. Hopefully, again, he's treating all the people working with him well, and I think if he wasn't, we'd have heard about that.
Yeah.
So I think it's a little bit of a mix of potentially some, I don't want to say generosity or whatever, but I think it's enlightened self-interest.
Yeah. Well, and the main reason I actually brought it up is just because I've seen a general trend at Image where more and more creators, outside of the ones that have already have their established base, like Jonathan Hickman or Jason Aaron, where you much more quickly see the price go to $14.99 or $16.99, sometimes even for the first trade. And that for some of the series may be because they know that their single issue sales aren't enough, that this is going to get more than one or two trades. So they have to capitalize now. But also there has been a long-term theory by retailers like Brian Hibbs that they disagree partially with the $9.99 cover price for the first trade, because their view, at least my understanding of Brian Hibbs, and I hope I get this generally correct, was that that for the initial trades, selling it instead of $9.99 but for $14.99, still a low enough entry point, and the amount of money that the creators are going to be getting from that, as well as the stores, make it a much more profitable profitable venture. And that the minimum price point for trades should be around that $12.99 to $14.99, and that it's much better in terms of the return on investment for the stores. And his claim was that the drop off in sales you'd see from $14.99 to $9.99 would be much less than the actual extra aggregate revenue and profit. Now, that's his argument. I don't know if I buy into that. And obviously, Image has continued to carry their $9.99 introductory price for a lot of their series. So maybe they aren't convinced either. But there's an aspect I was wondering if some of these creators are seeing their single issue sales, because you cover in the comics side of it how so many series so quickly drop to almost, you know, unsustainable levels. And then especially on the indie side, things start out at not 50, 60,000 units to begin with. So when you see these huge second, third, fourth issue drops, you know, a lot of times you're getting in within the first trade to levels where these series are unsustainable. So I'm wondering if some of this pricing change from $14.99 to $16.99 and from $9.99 to $14 or $16.99 is just the reality of our, you know how we used to talk about how Vertigo was a 60 issue series is what people shoot for.
Yeah.
Now if you can make it to 30, that's a great run. So I think there's this kind of truncation of what people think how long their series can last. And so they're having to subsequently price things differently and higher because they realize this is only going to be a 12 issue run because we just can't sustain it on the single issue side any longer. So we have to make the money we can on the trades.
Yeah, there's a lot in what you've said to unpack there. And I want to start by saying almost how inherently complex Image is to talk about in generalities.
Yeah, that's true.
Because, I mean, when you mention the Shadowline stuff, I mean, a number of different categories of books they do. There's studio books by the heads of the studio or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's the work for hire books within the studio or whatever. There's the Image Central line where it's a pay the $2,500 and they'll traffic the book for you.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is the kind of sort of self-published through one of the studios kind of lines where it's still creator-owned. It's not a page rate, you know. So there's so many things. And even within the Image Central pay the $2,500, there's the big name creators and the ones kind of almost scraping by.
Mm-hmm.
And each of those groups operates on a very different kind of financial reality. And I certainly think that from a reader perspective, a $9.99 trade versus a $14.99 trade, it's noticeably cheaper. It's 2/3 the cost. Therefore, a lower barrier to entry, people are more likely to try it. That mm-hmm. makes sense. But if we look at on the comic side, when we've had publishers do like those dollar or really low cost mm-hmm. first or zero issues,
mm-hmm.
and then they bump up to the $3.99 price point, we see that the dollar value they sell is roughly the same, but obviously mm-hmm. it's a fraction of the number of units.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes me wonder if kind of Brian Hibbs's point is when you go from a $9.99 initial trade to a $14 or $16.99 subsequent trade, do you see the corresponding drop-off to account for that shift in price? And would there be less of a drop-off if they'd had, say, $12.99 initial cover price?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think anything you can do to lower the barrier to entry initially is, as long as you're not losing money, is a good thing. Mm-hmm. I think also part of what's coloring Brian Hibbs's opinion there is being on the retail side of it, which obviously he is, and therefore it should color his opinion.
Mm-hmm.
The lower the price, the lower the margin.
Yeah.
So he would make more money on a slightly higher priced thing than they would. And it comes down to if you were to offer volume one of a new trade paperback Image du jour series at $9.99, what would you sell? $12.99, what would you sell? $14.99, what would you sell? And then the number of units, how does that work out in terms of the profit for the publisher, for the retailer, for Diamond, et cetera? Mm-hmm. What's most beneficial? Even if across those price points, and let's even go to a $19.99 initial cover price for a first volume. Let's say between those various price points, it works out evenly for the profit margin for everybody involved, okay? Which it wouldn't, but let's hypothetically say it does. Then it comes down to, from a philosophical perspective, are you better off, say, between that $9.99 and $19.99 theoretical cover price? You've got like a 2-to-1 difference in the number of people who've bought it or the number of units you've moved, which let's assume go to different people. Aren't you then spreading your risk of readers not coming back for the next volume substantially more on the lower cover price? And therefore, are you not better off from a risk perspective there than making the same money at the higher price point?
Mm-hmm.
And it's I would, from a purely academic point of view, think you're better off at the lower price point, but it's really hard to know for sure how this all plays out.
Yeah, and then there's just the aspect of in the comic world, the standard attrition thing, and it's like, from the retailer perspective, you've got to reap the revenue while you can, but then we always talk about, well, that mindset leads to the predatory, cover issues and variant covers and everything else, you know what I mean? And it's, are you selling the story or are you selling the object, you know?
Well, and Sam and I talk about that a lot because he's very much on the side for comics that it's selling the faux collectible object. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to argue against that. I think they're better off selling the story.
Yeah.
But given how many, variant covers, incentive covers, et cetera, that we see, they're clearly going after the collectible market, and I think that is short-sighted and very dangerous.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say that there is definitely a speculator bubble that exists right now, but I strongly suspect there is. And having, lived through the 90s, where that kind of bubble with the Valiant highly collectible images, the gold and silver covers at Image and stuff like that, that were literally just going gangbusters, until they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And man, there was a bubble burst, and within a few months period, or at least it felt like maybe it was a little longer period than that, Austin, Texas went from literally about 2 dozen stores to like 6.
Yeah.
And not all of those have survived. You know, but most of the stores that are still around here that I'm aware of were the ones that survived that that boom and bust.
Mm-hmm.
And we're selling worse now than we were back then. There aren't the million unit sort of things happening on any sort of regular basis. Star Wars number one's the only one I can think of out of the last decade or so. And if there is that speculator bubble and it bursts quickly and painfully, we could see not only stores going under, but that stores out of the very few that are still around, and even those that don't go under are going to be slashing their orders because they don't need to do the order X to get, you know, cover Y or whatever.
Yeah.
We could see these sales going from the level they're at, which is good, but not great, to is the industry going to stick around in the shape we know it today?
Yeah. I almost wonder if, you know, you talk about how you see some of the similar habits that the people are getting into just to prop the numbers up because, you know, they have to meet their quarterly numbers or whatnot. And I wonder if it's just the comics direct market is so flawed that you just have these 20-year, 25-year cycles where they get, you know what I mean? They just run themselves into the ground every so often. But you run the risk of, you know, if you have another crap market crash, do the big companies that own these producers now care enough to keep putting money in when they see, you know, a drastic fall, or if they would just write it off and say, well, we're going to license it out and we're going to do digital, you know, and then you make the money you can and we use the IP for all the other stuff.
Well, it's funny you asked me that today because just a few hours ago on the Slack channel, and I forget who posted it, but there was a list of comic shops in the direct market from 1979. Which was like in the infancy of the direct market. And it was responding to business pressures of, you know, sales aren't doing as great as they could on the newsstand racks at 7-Eleven or grocery stores or whatever. So let's get a direct market because that'll be a better business model. Now, that business model is, again, from the dawn of the 80s. We're getting close to 2020 here. Mm-hmm. You know, so we're talking literally a generation or so later, 40 years, and the nature of that direct market hasn't really evolved correspondingly with the changes in technology, consumer behavior, etc. So are we at the point where we need a new and better model? Probably. I think we're long past that. Are we at a point where we could sustain the shift to that model? That I'm not so sure about.
Yeah, I mean, that's the question is... You know, if we go into another one of these, like you said, the recession like in the 90s for the comics, you know, will enough stores survive or will the companies even care, you know, where they can just kind of wash their hands of it? I don't know.
Well, Marvel's already got their digital platform going strong with the Digital Comics Unlimited. DC's set up the DC Universe streaming service that also has comics. DC's reaching out into the Walmart comics and reprints and stuff there, trying to build up an audience there. Mm-hmm. From what I've seen, there is an audience there. How much of it is people like myself in the direct market saying, well, I can't get it through there, I'll have to get it through Walmart? And how much of it is speculators saying, well, other people can't get it through the direct market, so I'll sell it to them for a profit on eBay? I think if there was a speculator bust and that bubble bursts, that the money they are making through comics is so incidental that I don't know that they would spend the Herculean efforts they might need to keep that market afloat. I'm not sure they should.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, yeah, with the way the return on investment is, you know, on that end of it versus the movies, the TV and all that, yeah.
At some point in the last decade or more, I'm going to say more than that, the de facto ownership of what the properties are for superheroes and other comic-based material left the comic arena into the mass market arena. And it happened before the production kind of shifted. I remember back in the 90s when they were telling the what's often referred to as the Electric Blue Superman era, when he turned into that lightning kind of electrical-powered version of himself. There was a really nice cover image. I scanned it, I cleaned it up, and I just used that as a desktop image. And I had a coworker come over. It's like, well, who's that? Because I had this at work. And I'm like, well, that's Superman. He's like, no, it's not. And I'm like, well, it is. It's from an issue of Superman that you see the S. It's like, oh, that's not Superman. And to a degree, he was absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
That was before the Marvel movies, before the Justice League movie, before the CW shows, before Smallville even.
Mm-hmm.
Before there was a large canon of material around these properties in the mass media. I mean, even Walking Dead, more people know of it from the AMC show than from the comic. Do the comics really matter at that point? I mean, I would like to think that they do.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, especially when you get big enough companies where all they really see is like a spreadsheet with a line item. You get a little worried about them being like, you know, when they're told to cut 10%, 15%, and they start looking for small little departments. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And you could argue, oh, well, it's an IP farm. They're growing intellectual property there. As if they can't create new intellectual property, granted it's a higher cost, higher risk, in movie, TV, and other forms.
Yeah.
It just, it's a dangerous place for comics to be, and they've, between going for the collectability versus this is where the real story is, they've put themselves, I think, in a losing position.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's just, there's so many different players with different agendas that it creates, everyone's pulling in the different directions. You know what I mean? So.
Well, and add into that discussion the concept of licensed properties, where some of the stories that comics are telling are derivative story or stories based on, let me phrase it that way, properties from video games, movies, television, where they originated. So that kind of counts against the comics as an IP farm kind of argument.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really bizarre area for the industry to be in. I think the direct market can and should be stronger. I think part of it is a bit of an outdated system, and part of it is the way comics are being done on a individual comic side, chapters of a story, etc., price point. It's not conducive to getting new readers, which leaves the trades to kind of do that, which, again, lower price entry and stuff, I think, is a good thing. It's just we're not in that robust growing period of the market that I'm not sure it's, frankly, ever really been in. Well, let me rephrase that. Obviously, the beginning of the 90s, it was in boom mode in mm-hmm. terms of growth, in terms of, you know, explosive interest, etc. But it was so volatile that, again, when that speculator bubble burst early in the 90s, followed by the Heroes World fiasco, etc., the landscape of the direct market was irrevocably changed, and I don't see how it can get out of that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be an interesting couple of years to see what happens. Always is.
Well, we'll be here to follow it either up or down.
Yes. Hopefully up, probably down. If we look at the other couple of premier publishers of Boom, Dark Horse, Dynamite, and IDW, all said and done, they accounted for a little over 16.5% of the total units. Smack dab between under Boom and Dark Horse, but above Dynamite and IDW was Viz with 4.54% of the units. I think I don't say seeing a resurgence of manga, but we're seeing it in the direct market, whereas I think for a while it had moved out maybe to the bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Viz doing better again is good for the industry.
Absolutely.
If we jump over to the top trades, we had a very clear winner this time around at the top spot with Paper Girls Volume 5 trade paperback. Let's see, 8,961 units, which is almost twice what the next item did.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because this one item outsold all of the other new items for Image in the top 300 combined.
Oh, wow.
And this was... Let me see if I've got this right. Image had just a ton of reorder activity this month. They had 16,107 units of reorder activity in the top 300, which was a little over 50.5% of their total for the top 300. And this item alone worked out to roughly a quarter of their total for the top 300.
Uh-huh.
So they did pretty well with it. They only had a couple other items. Let's see, Ice Cream Man Volume 2 at rank 28, Wayward Volume 6 at rank 61, Wicked and Divine Volume number 3 at rank 77, and then from there it just kind of goes down and down and down, which isn't a bad thing. It's how the top list works. You start high and go down. but it really kind of, again, underscores how inherently complex Image just as a company can be, and how lopsided it can be between items that are doing, you know, topping the charts, and others that are squeaking by and in or below the top 300.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, to your earlier question about price point and stuff like that, it plays in. If you're a creator-owned property doing the $2,500 Image will traffic the book for you deal, you've got to be doing the math to figure out, well, how much am I making or losing on the individual issue side? If I've mm-hmm. got that long tail effect coming in on the trade side, what do I price them at to benefit from that without kind of cutting the sales?
Absolutely. And if people are interested in a really open creator that posts a lot of his thought process on that, along with some charts about his number of series that he's done, Jim Zub,
yeah,
who did Skull Kickers, and he did Wayward, and then he's doing other series. But he actually will break out as the series goes on, because I think each of his series has been probably like 20 to 30 to 40 issues. And he'll show you charts of how initially he starts off with a loss with the single issues. Then he starts to become, you know, more solvent with the initial trades. Then the hardcovers really help. But initially when he prints those hardcovers, he has like a big negative because he had to pay for all the printing for it. But he makes those up by selling them at the shows for full price. And then he has a few posts where he shows the digital over time really helps out make some of those single issues actually profitable, because, you know, they're always available and there's no cost to quote unquote reprint them. Do you know what I mean? So his articles are actually really fascinating about the overall long tail of the, you know, self creator. And I think it's really good to look at his stuff because he's not a Jonathan Hickman who has had tremendous success everywhere. So it's kind of like he has a built in audience. Jim Zub is kind of, obviously he's done work for the big two, but he has had to grind to get his creator-owned stuff, you know, up and going.
I think there's a lot more we can learn from people like him. Like you said, they're not the top of the charts, A-list, everybody knows their name in the industry sort of thing. He's doing, I don't say journeyman, he's more than that. He's got a good track record, he's done some really good work. And what's more than that is, like you said, he shares his learnings and his opinions not only through those articles, but I've gone to a couple of panels he's done at various conventions mm-hmm. that are just incredibly information rich. But the part that really floored me at, I think it was C2E2 the last time I went, he did one with a couple of people, and it feels like one of those freeform discussions. Oh, we're just going to have a couple of topics and just riff on it, open-ended.
Mm-hmm.
But what was different about it is he actually had a slide deck that actually at times had, I believe, some exact numbers and details and stuff like mm-hmm. that. So there was a clear agenda. It just felt like it was an ad hoc discussion as he's sitting there flipping the slide to the next thing. And I'm like, wow, this is something that he's clearly thought through, clearly has an agenda, yet it also has a natural flow to it of a conversation. It was one of the best panels I've been to on just process type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And again, in terms of how to write, how to sell, he's got a wealth of knowledge and practical knowledge on something that is not irrelevant to people starting out in the industry, like would be if it were, you know, like a Brian Michael Bendis or Brian K. Vaughan or Jonathan Hickman, whose works tend to be at the top of the charts because they are who they are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Zub's got that track record, yet it's something that is, again, I think applicable to everybody who would want to say, oh, I'd like to do an Image title or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's just, and I like that he shares, you know, his journey and how, you know, he even will say, you know, initially we just thought about, you know, single issues, collect editions, digital, like Comixology digital. But then he even talks about how, like, things like Humble Bundle and digital sales like that can feed in. And if you, you know, start, you know, with things like that where you think, okay, well, this looks like it's almost like giving away my material, but if I only give away the first one or two, you know, trades, and then what he would see is in the next couple months, his digital sales on other sales avenues would increase, or he'd see his trade sales increase. You know what I mean? So it's almost like, you know, loss leading other aspects of digital drive traffic to his page or to his regular stuff that people will then purchase. So it's just really interesting following his journey.
Well, and that begs the question, going back to the pricing of first volumes, if you can find a way to not need to recoup the benefit or whatever on the first volume and trade, can you then price it at a $9.99, discount it such that the retailer still makes roughly what they would have made if it were a $14.99 kind of a book, so they don't feel that they're losing out, and use that first volume, effectively give it away to be getting people to buy the second, third, fourth, and stuff. Again, that presumes you have a second, third, and fourth to do that with. Zub reminds me a lot of Brian Hibbs, in just instead of being a retailer, being a creator. But again, having experience, sharing it, getting the discussion going and stuff like that. And that's something that is so beneficial for the industry. Even if you're not in those areas, but just to understand the mindset of retailers, of creators, kind of why they do what they do, I think is really beneficial because it gives you a frame of reference when looking at sales numbers, when looking at other decisions the publishers and creators make. So, one other thing I want to talk about with Paper Girls specifically is I did do a quick chart on the comic side of it. And this is another one that does a couple of issues, does a pause, does a couple of issues, does a pause. The saga model, essentially. And on that first arc, that thing started, I don't know, around 75,000, dropped to around 46, 47,000, a little further, and then into the upper 30,000s at the end of that first arc. Then took a pause, came back a hair lower than where it had left, did the similar sort of drop-off over the five issues, paused, came in a little less, actually noticeably less, where it left, and then that kind of thing continues. Where if they had, frankly, if they had had issues in the middle of those gaps, by and large, I think it just would have kind of continued the same sales trend. But it's one of those where it just, effectively the series of mini-series approach, even though they've got consecutive numbering, I believe, we've seen this pattern play out where it's, again, that standard attrition over time. I really think whichever creator can find a way to effectively combat that wins.
I mean, wouldn't we just earlier talked about maybe the reason Kirkman has so many different people working on his books is to keep them coming out on time. And wasn't there a point at which he was almost, he was shipping to catch up to like where he should have been when he got behind? He was shipping more than one a month kind of thing.
But that goes back to around issue 40 of Walking Dead, where it gotten like a month or two late in enough things. And there was one month where an issue shipped 3 out of 4 weeks.
Oh, okay.
And that hurts the retailer because then each issue is the first one on the latest one on the rack for a very short window of time.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to sample a book, you're going to sample the latest issue. Most people, I personally, oh, they've got the last four, I'll get them, whatever. Yeah, it's just me though. I think again, the release schedule and stuff is one of those things, but what I'm seeing with Paper Girls is I don't know that the trend really would have changed much at all if it had not had the pauses.
Oh, gotcha. Gotcha. Because one thing I was going to make a comment on, but seeing this as the number one sales, is I distinctly remember reading in the previews or the previous previews that the series is ending. So, like they were saying, like they were starting the final arc. Do you know what I mean?
Interesting.
And final five or six series. And much similar to like Saga, which is, you know, was taking what, a year hiatus, probably because Fiona Apple was either burned out or it's not Fiona Apple, Fiona Staples was burned out and either wanted to do something else or just needed a break. I wonder if this is just the artist wanting to try something different, because it's clear to me by these numbers that they're still making quite a bit of money. You know what I mean? And this is just the direct market. Who knows what they're making on Amazon?
Well, on the single issue side, they've gotten to like a hair below 20,000.
Which when you hear from the creators of Wicked and Divine, 20,000 copies at Image, is you're still doing pretty well.
Oh yeah, well I would say even at Marvel and DC you're still doing pretty well. So I'm not saying that they're doing poorly. But at the rate they're going, they would probably be below 10,000 after another three arcs.
Okay.
If the trend continues.
So I was just surprised because I'm going to be honest with you. If you're an artist that can get, and obviously I think, you know, Cliff Chang's art is stellar, But if you can get hooked up with a writer like Brian K. Vaughan, who has a very dedicated audience, you know, similar to like Greg Rucka, obviously, you know, different, slightly different classes, different material. But it's almost like, I think a lot of these series are getting shorter than they would have otherwise, because Brian K. Vaughan has a history of doing 60 issue series. It's because I think the artists either want to do different things, or they're just getting burnt out, or that, you know, even with the schedule that they've come to, I think it's just, I think just you just see shorter runs now. You just don't see people do as long a runs.
And your theory is it's as much on the creator side, more so the artist maybe than the writer, but then on the audience side.
Oh, absolutely. Because I think that for Brian K. Vaughan, I mean, you know that Saga sells like 10 times as much in the non-direct market than the direct. I mean, you don't know, but you
I
know
don't know that. I don't know that.
Yeah, for sure. I'm just telling you, there's no way that they don't sell thousands and thousands of copies of the trades on Amazon, because one of the things I spend a lot of time on Amazon, and you can tell when things are very popular by the number of reviews for certain things. Like you'll see like Harry Potter books, you know, tens of thousands of reviews, you know, things that, you know, sell millions of copies. And then so in that same vein, when you look at comic collections of how many reviews there are, what, you know, that are constantly raked in the top selling version of that, they sell a lot of copies of Saga. Let's just put it that way.
I'm not doubting that, but I don't know how many they sell. But I think one indication to your point is if you filter this list to titles containing Saga and look for specifically Saga from Image versus, you know, Saga of Swamp Thing and others that we're not going to care about at the moment, mm-hmm. all 9 volumes of the trade are on the list. The two deluxe hardcovers are on the list. And just the trades, which are the only ones that landed in the top 300, Saga accounted for over 20% of the Image top 300 trade sales for the month, and it's on hiatus.
Yeah, well, and it, I mean, even I think Brian K. Vaughan was honest with the when they went on hiatus for that, it was because Fiona needed a break. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
So that book is almost like Walking Dead in that it mints money, so it can't be because they're not making it. You know, it's because she chooses to want to do something more different creatively for a little bit, or, you know, she's burned out. You know, one of the two.
Yeah, neither is a good situation, but if they can give her time to go recharge her creative batteries elsewhere and stuff, that's a win for everybody, including the creative team. What's interesting is if you look at the ordering of the volumes, it's obviously 9, or not obviously, but volume 9 was the top selling, then number 1, then 8, then 2, then 3, then 7, then 4, then 6, then 5 there at the end. It's that exact kind of V formation that we typically see that I feel is indicative of people starting out and people kind of finishing off, if you will. Mm-hmm. And there's more at those ends than kind of in the middle, you know, of the cycle of books.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's just interesting that we're seeing, you know, Paper Girls is coming to an end when I believe it's still very successful. Then that one, actually, I think it said it was an end. Now, will it do something similar to like how Descender is, where they ended Descender but started Ascender? Maybe there's like a different different series coming after a break, or is it a real end, or is it, you know, and then you have Saga, which is like a year hiatus, and we'll see how that comes back, you know?
Yeah, does it come back as Paper Women or something?
Yeah, or you know what I mean, like something like where they, you know, for Descender it was, you know, that strategy that you see sometimes where the sales go down to a level that's not sustainable, so then they try to re-jump start it, even though it's technically the same book. I mean, the big two do it all the time. They do it super lame ways, you know, like with putting the legacy numbering and a number one on the same page or on the same thing, and you know.
Yeah. But yes, I know that. That one I know.
But yeah, so it's just interesting because I was the reason it brought it up. I brought it up is because seeing this as the number one trade sale for the month, and seeing it's a pretty healthy margin over the others. You know, a lot of that is just, you know, Brian K. Vaughan has a pretty dedicated audience, and Cliff Chang is a top tier artist. You know, it's a popular book. It's done well. It's a very well done product. But I was just surprised to see recently that they're saying that it's ending. So.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that's interesting is it's the only. There's only one other Image book in the top 25, and it's at rank 25, and that's Saga Volume 9 at 1,623 units of reorder activity. Mm-hmm. So we're at a month where, just because of luck of the draw, what came out and stuff, Image didn't have a lot of their kind of heavy hitters release a trade this month.
Yeah, and that's one of those things where a lot of their stuff is at, you know, the mercy of the creators, getting stuff out on time, sticking to the actual publishing schedule. And sometimes it goes right and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah. And again, that is what makes Image so hard to talk about compared to other publishers, because they have far less control over their output than, say, a Marvel or a DC would.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of DC, the item number 2 on the list is Batman Volume 8 Cold Days Trade Paperback, 4,563 units. That is, I believe, reprinting the story where Bruce Wayne is on the jury of a case involving Mr. Freeze,
mm-hmm.
which actually was a good, I thought, storyline or whatnot, completely disconnected to the events of the preceding issue of The Wedding. But, you know, hey, go figure.
Yeah. Well, you know, continuity is the first casualty in the big two these days, so.
Well, the current storyline in Batman of the Price, which is crossing over with the Flash, interrupted flat in the middle of the other ongoing storyline the title had been telling that'll pick up after the two-issue crossover.
Yes, it's an interlude, right?
Sure, we'll go with that. That sounds so much nicer than what I might have called it.
Than what it really was, yeah.
Interruption is the word that came to my mind.
Yeah, ugh, yeah, no fun. Well, I even remember when Tom King first started out his Batman run, it was almost torpedoed by that Monster Men crossover, which was terrible at the very beginning. Was it like in issue 6 or 7 or something like that?
Yeah.
When he just started over, that was terrible itself in that crossover.
Absolutely. That was one that just totally interrupted what was going on in multiple books.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's a poor editorial decision. And when I was recording the night before that, with Sam and Eric, we talked a lot about kind of impact of editorial on comic sales.
Mm-hmm.
When they make decisions like that and whatnot, or don't make decisions like that. Because I think we're seeing some not so good times on the monthly side of Batman, with it getting down in sales that it hadn't been during the entire Rebirth era for the first mm-hmm. time, I think below 90,000.
Do you think that's a consequence of the storytelling or the double shipping at $3.99, or just you just see more rapid attrition with the big two? I know Batman is such an outlier on all aspects, but it is just interesting to think, you know, which one of it is, or is it all four, you know, all of it?
Well, I think whatever answer somebody pops out with may give insight as to their personal bias. Mm-hmm. Somebody who's upset with the cost of comics can say, well, clearly it's the $3.99 price point. Somebody who's upset with how fast it's coming out, clearly it's coming out too fast. I'm upset with the story, so I'm going to say, clearly it's the story. So I definitely think all of it plays into it. I personally think that the shipping speed is a force multiplier and not necessarily a force in and of itself in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
If you're loving the book, getting it faster is great. You love that. If you're not liking the book, it burns you out faster on the book. And if you're just ho-hum on it, it almost forces a decision sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm.
Price point, if you're really liking the book, you'll pay more for it.
Yeah.
If you're not, you won't. So it, again, is more of a decision incentivizer than... And certainly, if you can't afford it, you can't afford it, and it does factor into that. But this is where I'd like to have point-of-sales and reader information on sales, to where we could see if, when they bumped stuff up to $3.99 and went twice a week, did the overall purchases of people stay the same dollar amount, but they just are against fewer books? Did they shift what they were getting? So yeah, Batman stayed more or less even, but man, other books dropped by the wayside. You know, what are those factors?
Mm-hmm.
And that takes more granular data than we've got, and it takes a deep dive into that data to have theories, test the theories, and see which ones hold water.
Yeah.
And this is where I really think Comics Pro in particular needs to step up to the plate to be collecting that data from as many of their members as they can, to be analyzing that data, and to come out with actionable things that publishers and creators can do based on hard data. When you do this, it does not work because of that, and you should do this instead.
Yeah.
Because until we get to that point, it's easy to pontificate saying, well, I think they ought to do this, and it's easy to come back with counterexamples of, Well, yeah, I agree. They probably ought to. But if you look at it from a strictly business and dollars and cents point of view, when you say, oh, they ought to be doing less variant covers, well, that potentially is leaving money on the table. Oh, they should discount the first volume of a trade. Then you get somebody like a Hib saying, yeah, but I like make less money, therefore it's bad. You know, It's there's so many different perspectives and aspects on this that a lot of things seem like a brilliant idea on the surface, but just really don't work out well, Which is unfortunate.
Yeah, it's complicated to say the least.
Yeah. But I'm seeing and hearing a lot more people getting kind of frustrated with Tom King than overjoyed by what he's doing in Batman. So I'm expecting us to see a bit of a continued downtrend on the sales. I could have just as easily prefaced that with, due to standard attrition, we're going to see a downtick on the sales.
Mm-hmm.
Or just left that as the argument, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully DC will pick some stuff up, because I'd really like them to, but I'm just not happy with them right now.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
Item number 3 on the list from Dark Horse, Avatar The Last Airbender Imbalance Part 1 trade paperback, 4,074 units. This is another licensed property that Dark Horse has been doing well with, even though they've been kind of doing quietly. They've had a number of library editions and whatnot that I was getting at one point, but I just, the cadence of them was hard for me to kind of keep up with when they were soliciting the next or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of fell off of that, but I really enjoyed the Last Airbender series, so I'm not surprised they're having good luck with the continued trades, original to trade stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next item is also original to trade. It's Saban's Power Rangers Soul of the Dragon graphic novel, 3,217 units. That was continuing the adventures of the Tommy Oliver character, who was the original Green Ranger, original White Ranger, then became Zeo Red and Dino Thunder Black. He was another, all five of those, I think. He was a total of five. He was the Red Turbo Ranger. I forgot that. That was the one I forgot. This was Kyle Higgins doing it. He was the one who'd had a great deal of success with the Shattered Grid storyline that Boom had done. Hopefully this has done well enough for Boom that they decide to do some more original to trade stuff for the Power Rangers.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I thought this was a really good showing for that. I know that they'd been kind of building up a series of books on that, and you had reviewed a number of them, and they were working for you, right?
Yeah, I've been very happy with what they're doing. A few issues behind. When I say I'm a few issues behind, I just want to clarify. I had caught up by the end of the year, and we've had 9 shipping weeks, and I'm not entirely 9 weeks behind, but I am behind on all of 9 weeks. Let me put it that way. So I'm behind on what they've been doing last month or two, but overall, I've been really enjoying what they're doing. And I think the original to trade format would be a good way for them to tell self-contained stories for over time for each of the different Power Ranger teams,
mm-hmm.
to where they could build up a library of, oh, you like Power Rangers. Well, what team did you really like? Oh, you liked Wild Force. Well, here's a trade on that. Oh, you liked Dino Thunder. Here's a trade. Or you like this or that. Here you go. To me, that would be a long-term strategy, much like what had been done for Doctor Who, of telling mini-series for each of the different Doctors over time to build up a library of Doctor Who trades.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I'm hoping that now that the property is switched from Saban to Hasbro, it looks like there's still good relationships between Hasbro and Boom and stuff on that. I hope that continues, even though almost all of the other Hasbro properties are over at IDW.
Yeah. Speaking of IDW, a recent piece of news that I thought I was really kind of blown away with, and I want your overall opinion on a couple ideas, is did you see the news that Usagi Yojimbo is going to IDW?
I did. I was surprised by that.
I was very surprised by that for a number of reasons. And I'm wondering if, did you also hear recently, maybe in the last 6 months, about the news that there was a rather decent sized chunk of Dark Horse that was either sold or a big investment from a Chinese firm?
Yes, and Sam, Eric, and I talked a little bit about that, but not too much on the comics side. But the bottom line is, because of that investment, it's not like Dark Horse is suddenly in financial, dire straits or anything like that.
Okay.
But it also may be kind of Mike Richardson's geared towards a retirement plan.
Yeah, that's what I was also thinking. He's been there quite a long time. But I was just also wondering, the interesting thing on the Usagi Yojimbo to IDW is if you followed any of the IDW news, even outside the comics, comics world, and the Beat has some good reporting on this, they've actually been losing a ton of money on their entertainment side, their TV and movie side, so much so that they've had a lot of turnover in their executives, and they're not even like they're contracted to send a second or third season of Wynonna Earp to Sci-Fi, but they haven't started filming it because they've had a hard time coming up with the money for it.
Well, that's a bad situation.
Yeah. So, and they've turned over a bunch of their executives based on like they're losing quite a bit of money. And in fact, I guess that one of the investors that owns a big chunk of it now had to like put in like a big chunk of money to kind of keep them going. And so it's just interesting to see, you know, and they've had some different changes on their licensing side, in that they kind of, in my opinion, made a mistake when they did all that crossovers with the Transformers, ROM, and you know, all that crossover.
That's
stuff.
When I bowed out of the Hasbro subuniverse over at IDW.
They were also losing some money on the comic side, so it's just interesting to see Osagie Yojimbo go over there, and I can see a big draw for him to go over there. Maybe they gave him a pretty sweet deal, but they're recoloring everything for him, so that was probably included in his deal.
Actually, Eric gave me a little insight on that when I recorded with him and Sam, or maybe Sam did, I forget which one mentioned it, but I think it was Sam, actually, that Fantagraphics still has some kind of ownership stake in what they had published of Usagi, because they had it before Dark Horse. And it seemed to be that they have the black and white rights or something like that for the reprints or something.
Gotcha.
So maybe for IDW to reprint the earlier material, they have to color it.
Interesting, yeah. But I was just trying to think of why he would go over there, because it just was my understanding that Dark Horse had always treated him so well, and he was able to do basically whatever he want, you know, just keep doing his series, chugging along, and for as so long as he's done it. So I was just very surprised, and then just kind of that news with all the upheaval I've seen about the news about IDW having financial problems, at least on their entertainment end. It was just interesting.
I imagine one of the things that may have gotten Stan Sakai over there is the fact that, I guess it's which of the Turtles creators is kind of the house artist or whatever over at IDW. They've got his own studio. I think it's Eastman. I think it's Kevin Eastman, yeah. And obviously Usagi's teamed up with the Turtles a couple of times, been on the cartoon, whatever, so I'm sure he's got good relations. And if Eastman's saying, well, yeah, it's worked out great for me, they may have made a really good offer to Sakai. And hopefully they did, because, again, I got on board Usagi far later than I really should have. I was aware of it early in its gestation, back around when Turtles was first coming out. When it was first coming out, I had a good friend of mine from high school that I'm still in touch with and stuff, that in high school he's saying, oh, yeah, I'm reading this. It's fun.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a really good judge of story.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah. He's somebody, it's not just some random guy said it, somebody whose opinion on these sorts of things I really trust and value. I just didn't get on it at the time, and I wish I had. I didn't get on board until issue like 116 or something within the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just it's one of my absolute favorite series. I have all the Dark Horse put out kind of like a oversized collections of kind of like two or three trades at a time, and I have all those. So it'll be interesting to see how that turns out, and you know, if the recolored ones look really good, maybe I'll have to, you know, dip in again. You know how that goes.
Yeah, I try not to do that too often, but I do it.
Yeah. Well, the thing is it's one of my favorite series, so it's kind of like, you know, you're absolutely right. For a lot of comic stuff, I was like, well, I have the version I have and it's fine for me. But there's a few ones that I have a few different versions of, digital, the collected, the hardcover kind of thing. So,
well, I've got the two hardcover slipcase edition that Fantagraphics did of their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've got the first 26, I think, trades that Dark Horse did, because that got me up to where my issues started.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, I need to go through and read them, and who knows, maybe we'll do that as a back issue spotlight or something.
Yeah, no, they're great. They're a great story. There's a specific series, specifically like within those 26, because that's actually how I originally read it too, was in the collected editions. There's two or three collected edition segments like that. They're continuing one, like Grass Cutter 1, Grass Cutter 2 kind of thing, where they're continuing stories over the whole volumes. And there's some really good 2 to 3 set series, collected edition series that are just tell like one overarching story that are really, really, really good.
Yeah. He's a great storyteller, and because it's anthropomorphic, it visually sets it apart from other stuff on the rack. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's something that I think more people ought to be reading.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I was surprised given that it seemed he had really good relationships with Dark Horse that, it felt out of the blue that he was shifting publishers.
Yeah, and that's why I was trying to like make connections on, well, maybe this new Chinese company that came in and has invested money in Dark Horse wants to do things differently, and they're, you know, not necessarily, you know, focused on creator-owned stuff. They're more focused on licensing stuff. Because I have noticed an uptick in licensing material from Dark Horse. But at the same time, they have the Jeff Lemire Black Hammer world that they're building. So, you know, they still do creator-owned stuff. So it's just interesting.
Well, in Dark Horse, and again, Sam, Eric, and I were talking about this, there are a couple of publishers, Dark Horse, Boom, among them, that have, in hindsight, very clear periods of their publishing history that are markedly different than the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you look early at Dark Horse, it was very much creator-owned stuff with Boris the Bear and that kind of stuff. There's that kind of period where Star Wars was a really big factor. Now, again, it's the Black Hammer universe.
Mm-hmm.
Over at Boom, there was kind of the, when Mark Waid was in charge of doing a lot of the stuff, there was a bit more creator-owned stuff. There's an earlier period of Boom where it was almost like scripts that would have been for a sci-fi movie of the week sort of thing. You know, some of these smaller publishers, their identity and nature evolves over time. And that's not a bad thing. As the market changes, so should the publishers.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely looking like Dark Horse is potentially entering a new phase of their existence. And whether it's going to be defined by things like Hellboy, BPRD, Black Hammer, and stuff like that, or something else, time will tell.
Yeah, that's a good point. But yeah, that was those were the couple pieces of news that I found pretty fascinating, was the IDW struggling on their entertainment end, and then another property leaving Dark Horse, you know, because they recently, you know, they lost the Buffy and the Whedonverse, basically, and Serenity and all that. And then, you know, now Stan Sakai. So it's just interesting, quite a bit of shifting.
Yeah. And it's easy for a publisher to get a little too reliant on licensed properties to their detriment. I think Devil's Due was a good example of that. They were so reliant on G.I. Joe and some other stuff that when they lost that property, and I believe at the time it went to IDW, that pretty much spelt the end of Devil's Due.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, Dreamwave got on the map with Transformers. It went from more or less not existing to number one comic on the charts 1 month. And I'm like, where did that come from? And if that doesn't show the power of property over creator, I don't know what does.
Mm-hmm.
So what else do we have on the list that looks interesting?
I highlighted a little bit further down item number 20 from Lionforge Sheets, which is like kind of an original graphic novel that seems to have been doing pretty well for them. And it was pretty much in all ages. I mean, it's probably maybe like for middle-aged kids and up. But I thought it was pretty good, and it was you know, well-priced and a, you know, good 200 pages. And I thought that would, there's some things I really like about Lionforge. Obviously we've also seen some news with them about retrenching, cause they had such a big expansion, and so much acquisitions and so much, you know, bigger presence and previews that we've talked in the past about how we didn't quite understand if it was sustainable or if they were going to be able to match sales with how much they were putting out. And so maybe they got, you know, a little overexcited, but they are putting out good work. And I just wanted to highlight this one. And they do a lot of different stuff. They have kind of, you know, silos that they put, you know, certain books in and really try to target certain audiences. And I like that they're trying different things, and they try to bring some European stuff over. They try to do a lot of stuff for kids that's, you know, clearly marketed at kids that a lot of the other publishers don't really market to, at least in the direct market. Obviously we know in the main market, Barnes & Noble and at Amazon, that there's publishers that are really focused on that. So, but it's good to see in the direct market and them have some success as well.
I agree. I think Lionforge has got a couple of very clear different avenues they're going down, and they're having some definite successes in some of them, maybe a little less so in a few other areas.
Mm-hmm.
As much as I've enjoyed the Catalyst Prime kind of superhero universe, I don't know if I would say it's an overwhelming success by any stretch of the imagination, but I think it's so good that they're doing it, and they're trying to get heroes that are different than the standard Marvel DC ones.
Yeah.
And I respect that, and I've enjoyed some of their European stuff. Ghost Money I thought was brilliant.
Yeah.
So I think it's good for them to be in the market and doing what they're doing. Do think it'd be good for them to have a little bit more success here and there. It's just, it's a tough market, and I think hard for them to really get the solid foothold that they need to have that success.
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, especially in the direct market, when you're a back-of-the-book publisher, it's just always going to be a struggle. You know, I think that they do pretty well in the library market. They do pretty well, you know, exploring all their avenues, but it's just not easy going in the direct market.
Now, you're more up on the library market than I am. And I guess the question I've got, particularly around this sort of stuff, is how much of a difference does it make? Because both the direct market and the library market are kind of curated markets.
Mm-hmm.
But with the direct market, it's curated by retailers from a very dollars and cents point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas from the library market, I think it is, and maybe I'm totally wrong on this, but I think it's curated more from almost, I want to say, an artistic point of view as to what's going to have enough kind of literary or serious merit mm-hmm. to get people to check it out more than once.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, I'm not an expert, but I do get a lot of material from the library, and I'm constantly on the library websites looking at what they have in terms of graphic novels and comics. And I will tell you, they're, you know, they do operate a lot differently in the sense of what they decide to buy. It's first off, they have a budget, right, for the mm-hmm. overall library. And then each section gets, you know, subsequent certain amount of that, a budget. And for the graphic novel and comics section, a lot of it, you know, there is still a slight shade on in terms of what they spend their money towards is books for kids. So that's why I actually think the Lion Forge has a little bit of an advantage there, is because they have such specific different sections of their publishing platform that is marketed towards kids at different ages. You know, their Quillian, the Kids Club or Lion, I can't remember the different marketing terms for it, but they have very distinct age brackets that they market books towards. And that I think is one of the reasons why they do well in the library market, because librarians, you know, have a limited amount of time, and the more information you give them about what target audience things that are appropriate for, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like if they're specifically looking, I have $1,000 this month for graphic novels, and I need to buy, I need to hit, you know, ages 4 to 6. I need to hit ages 10 to 13. And I need to hit the teenagers. Well, you know, a lot of the teenagers are going to buy Marvel, DC, superhero stuff. But for some of the younger stuff, obviously they're going to gravitate towards first, second. They're going to gravitate towards, you know, some of the trade publishers that are putting out the original graphic novels, like the Reign of Telgemeier stuff. But, you know, in terms of a lot of like the library system that I'm at, they have quite a good selection. And so they are seeing this Lion Forge material, because I see it all the time, and especially on the digital side.
Mm-hmm.
We have access to an app called Hoopla,
right,
which has a very good section on comics and graphic novels. And I see almost everything that Lion Forge publishes available there to check out. And so either Lion Forge has made it very convenient for libraries or very affordable, or they have a rep that specifically promotes this to the librarians. Because that's the other thing, is the librarians have conferences that they go to, and vendors have the option of basically trying to sell them on their wares, just like any other client. And I think that Lion Forge, you know, is invested in the library system, and that they go to them and say, we have this material that's very specific for ages 4 to 6. It's completely safe, you know, because that's the other thing, as a librarian, the last thing you want is a parent come to you saying, this is inappropriate material for my kid.
Absolutely.
So they're very, you know, just like a direct market retailer won't put certain comics on the front of the display right in front of the register or in the kids section, the librarians have to be careful about that, you know, and the easier it is for them to determine what's safe to get for certain sections of the library, the easier, the more likely they are to make a purchase. You know what I mean?
Okay, let me ask this then. Would it be a viable publishing model for a company starting out to attempt to target the library as their primary market for the stay-in-business aspect of things, while targeting the direct market with the goal of at least doing well enough in there to stay in there?
That is a very good question. And because I don't actually work at a library,
yeah.
Because I think someone that worked at a library who had an understanding of like how many libraries like nationally are in the digital space and have things like Hoopla, or how many libraries are consistently every month have a dedicated budget to comics and graphic novels. I will guarantee you that major metropolitan libraries absolutely do, but rural libraries may not. You know what I mean? So whereas you could originally say, well, there's thousands of libraries in this country. Well, but maybe only 800 of them actually have budgets and actually have it, that allow them to buy graphic novels and comics. You know what I mean? So I wouldn't know that those exact breakdowns. And you would have to know that information before you made a decision about something like that.
Oh, absolutely. It just seems like that would be a very interesting way to hedge your bets against the fickleness of the direct market,
mm-hmm.
and potentially find a way to avoid the need of a lot of smaller publishers to do the variant incentive covers and stuff like that just to kind of stay in business.
Yeah. And I will say that on the Hoopla app that I get through, which is basically the Phoenix Public Library System, which is the major library system, at least in the Maricopa County, which is the center of Arizona, is they have a lot of Image as well. And obviously Image, you know, for most of their creators, as much revenue as they can get is good in, you know, exploring different avenues. And, you know, the library system I'm part of has a big push towards serving teens and young adults. So obviously, you know, comics and graphic novels are a natural fit for that. So they dedicate significant resources. I just don't know if a rural library in Alabama makes the same choices. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. But the thing is, you may not need that rural library in Alabama or wherever to do it if you've got enough in the major metropolitan areas, you know, mm-hmm. because like a Los Angeles area is going to have a number of libraries and such.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you can target the right ones and almost cater to them, mm-hmm. something that you could then also sell in the direct market.
I will say that it's probably a lot more feasible now that you have things like Overdrive and Hoopla, which allow you to get digital versions available to everyone. And especially now that who are you targeting with a lot of this material? Teenagers and kids. And what do those kids have available? Screens in the form of smartphones, iPads, laptops. They're used to interacting with everything on the screen. And a lot of the material that I see that's kind of been the variety that I've seen is available through the digital apps, which is also nice for the library in that a lot of their business models for those apps and whatever is you buy, you know, you lease or whatever the copies that you want. And then if something becomes less popular, the next time you renew the lease for that issue or whatever, you can, instead of having 10 copies, you can have one or two, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it allows them to curate the digital stacks a lot easier than the paper stacks, because those paper stacks, basically every 6 months, they just put out for sale in front of each library what they can't use as much anymore, you know, as books become popular, less popular over time.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, yeah, I think it's more feasible now that a lot of the libraries are jacked into different, you know, the different Overdrive, 3M, like the Hoopla. There's different ones for movies and music now, too. So I think there's more opportunity. I don't know enough about the exact numbers of who participates and all that to be able to definitively say you could make a go of it as a company, you know?
It certainly would be an interesting approach to take. And I wonder if that's one of the things that Lions Forge is doing,
mm-hmm.
is, you know, leveraging some of these outside the direct market venues, just to kind of shore some stuff up.
Oh, absolutely. And I think even, you know, DC and Marvel, try to reach in some of that because, you know, the DC Supergirls and the couple new lines that are clearly marketed towards kids, you see them getting a big push and getting prevalence on the advertising pages that the Hoopla has at the library. So they'll have, you know, they have like a digital carousel of like the newest releases, right? And you prominently, you'll see popular stuff, and every once in a while you'll see stuff that's a little more obscure, but you'll see a lot of those you know, stuff that's targeted towards those kids, like the DC Supergirls, you know,
superhero girls, but yeah,
superhero girls, you know what I mean? So I don't know if that's the library, just that's what's popular, so that's what they're going to show on the digital carousel, or if, you know, maybe there's some co-op where the publishers give them a few free extra copies if they, you know, advertise them, quote unquote. I don't know how that works, but yeah.
Yeah, but I think the DC Superhero Girls, of which there are a couple of items, I think, on the list this time, they're clearly reaching out to the young adult audience and the younger reader audience and such, and they're going where that audience is.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that audience simply doesn't get into comic stores.
Absolutely.
And given a couple of comic stores I've been into, I totally get it. A couple others, it's like, no, they should go to those.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, one of the ones I went to in your neck of the woods, I'm forgetting which one it was. I was blown away by what a nice story it was. It had a good kids area. It was well organized. It was well lit. Very friendly. It'd been around like 20 years or something.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm blanking on the name, and I apologize for that, because it's one I'd very much like to recommend to listeners and stuff, because it's, again, terrific store. I've been in a few where just about the minute I walk in, particularly if I go with my sister, she's like, yeah, I'll wait in the car. One or two, she kind of refused to even get out of the car. And there was one in Southern California where she did that, and I didn't spend too long in it, and I got back. It's like, yeah, you made the right choice. It literally, it had just piles of stuff all over the place. It was chaotic. It was unfriendly, I think, unwelcoming.
Uh-huh.
And so I think a lot of potential readers of comics are more likely to be found online, going to libraries or actual bookstores or something that, frankly, are at times a little more professional. That having been said, we've also got some awesome comic stores in the nation that are the best place to go for both getting comics and getting directed to the right comic for you.
Uh-huh.
So it's one of those things that I think the library system may be the equivalent of the spinner rack in some respects of getting people introduced to comics and getting them on board.
Oh, absolutely.
And doing it digitally, like you are saying, is a low cost way, because you don't have to pay printing and shipping and stuff like that. It could be an interesting way for some publishers to kind of get a foothold enough in the market to stick around for the long haul that they would need to have success.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I wanted to mention, jumping down to rank 73, is a new Challengers trade paperback from DC, 901 units. This is one of the various New Age of Hero books. I don't want to say it's one of the failed New Age of Heroes books, because I don't know that really any were great successes. It collected the entire 6-issue run, and again, you know, that's 900 units, so maybe one out of 2 or 3 or 4 stores got it.
I would definitely agree with you. It does not look like it was successful. Let's put it that way.
Well, and then there's also a couple of ranks below the first volume of Curse of Brimstone. It collects the first 6. I think there'll be enough for another trade, maybe even a slightly larger trade, because I think it went to like 13 or 14 issues in an annual, maybe. But that did 884 units. It's just, by and large, a lot of what they did for the New Age of Heroes didn't really catch on.
Mm-hmm.
Another example, I guess, would be the way to phrase it. We've got Cave Carson has an Interstellar Eye, which is part of the Young Animals line that's, I think, completely over now. 847 units.
Mm-hmm.
This is where DC trying to do these, in the case of Young Animals, a curated line, in the case of the New Age of Heroes, essentially a Marvel line. It just didn't work.
Yeah.
And I don't think either of those are particularly surprising.
Yeah. I think they were hoping for better results, but they got what they got.
I would hope they were hoping for better results. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Well, I think they also, wasn't that partly, I mean, it probably was in works longer than that, but it was also partly a response to Marvel, one of the Marvel people saying that artists don't matter anymore, basically.
I don't know.
Well, I thought there was like, was it Quesada or was it someone else was at one of the cons, and they said that the artist was that they were had a very hard time marketing artists to sell, to actually move books. Do you know what I mean? And so then DC came out with this New Age of Heroes, and they always put the artist's name first, and they focused on the artist. You know what I mean? It was kind of like a reaction to that. At least that was my understanding. Maybe I misinterpreted that.
Even if it was, the fact that their properties were so easily identifiable as existing Marvel properties.
Yeah.
kind of tainted that sort of experiment in terms of going back to an artist-driven approach on selling books.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're going to say that the big draw is this artist, be it Kenneth Rocafort or whomever, and it's a new and interesting property, yeah, sure. But when you've got one property that looks like it's the Hulk, another that looks like it's the Defenders, another that looks like it's essentially Spider-Man.
And Fantastic Four and all that, yeah.
Yeah. It's hard to say, well, this is an artist-driven initiative.
Mm-hmm.
Or even if it is, it seems overshadowed by, yeah, but couldn't you come up with riffs on I don't know, DC properties? I mean, you could argue that New Challengers was, I mean, clearly it was a revival of a DC property. But even that's one that is closely identified with the Fantastic Four.
Mm-hmm.
You know, science adventurers or whatnot. So I think they muddied the waters there, and the way they pitched it initially, I don't think was particularly successful. In the fact that they all died out kind of soon, I saw that coming.
Yeah.
But that had nothing to do with almost the specifics of this. Every other time, either Marvel or DC has done a new line of comics branded in a particular way with new characters or whatnot, it almost always fizzles out within a year or two.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from the M-Tech line over at Marvel to the various runs at doing the Red Circle characters over at DC with both Impact, which lasted a little while, and again, the Red Circle stuff itself of more recent vintage. They just don't seem to put either enough effort into it or enough marketing to have any kind of serious success.
Yeah, I think we just have seen that in a lot of ways, the superhero stuff, people apparently are satisfied with what they can get from the main lines. You know, that's kind of what they want. You know, I guess the sales eventually speak for themselves, right?
Would you say they're satisfied given how often they have to end and redo those titles?
Yeah, you're right. Satisfied is a poor, is not the right word, but it means, I mean, we've talked about this in the past. Look how hard it is to create a new character that sticks. And yeah, they may stick for a year or two, but then, you know, we've talked in the past about, you know, the only characters that really stuck in the last 10, 15, 20 years have been like Venom, Carnage, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it would be interesting to go year by year of recent years to see which characters have kind of been introduced and stuck.
Yeah, and even them, they're not even like, I mean, maybe Venom now is a B-list character currently with Donny Cates writing it, but for the most part, they're still C-list characters. You know, they're not even like frontline characters, you know what I mean? So, I don't know. It's just, and then also there's the creators have learned from 30 years of bad contracts that you probably shouldn't put a lot of effort into creating characters for Marvel DC. So, there's kind of this double-edged reason for it.
Well, yeah, I think the publishers have disincentivized the creators to really do, you know, create put the effort in to create a new potentially evergreen character, because they've seen historically how little benefit there is to them in that.
Yeah, I mean, even look on the DC side, you know, the only thing I can remember from the last couple years is the Court of Owls from Scott Snyder's, you know, that have kind of somewhat persisted, but they're not like a book driver, you know what I mean? They're just used as like kind of like a plot point or a villain, you know, with their assassins that they have, you know what I mean? The owls or whatever.
The talons and stuff.
Talons, yeah, the talons, you know, and even then, if we go 5 years from now, will that even be a thing, you know? So, I don't know.
Well, and the Court of Owls may get used in a movie or TV show, but they're never going to be the title character.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you go with what has been a title character or, you know, whatnot in a comic of late that looks successful, I would go with Weapon H as a strong possibility, even though it's obviously very derivative of Hulk and Wolverine. Mm-hmm. But I'd be hard-pressed to name too many other new characters that have been, you know, title featured, whether they mm-hmm. were literally the title character or not, that were likely to remember or care about a year and a half from now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's a really high bar to reach. You know, once these new age of heroes titles end, how much are we going to hear of Damage, Sideways, Silencer, or any of the even more forgettable ones?
Yeah.
And what's an A-list character and what's not, I think gets murky because you can do it based on the comics or based on what kind of impact these characters have outside of the comics.
Mm-hmm.
Again, your comment about Venom being a C-list character, even though Donny Cates is doing some great stuff with the character right now in the comics, he got a movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. So maybe I was a little harsh in terms of that, but you know what I mean, though. Like, he's not on the front line. Like, you're not going to see Venom in the Avengers, well, at least in the movies. But yeah, I'm just trying to think of characters that have stuck around, you know, that are relevant.
Yeah, again, after Venom, who has stuck around for 30 some odd years or whatever, at both Marvel and DC, it's much fewer and further between.
Yeah.
And sometimes the ones that do it in surprising ways. I would say Cyborg, who was created in the 80s for the New Teen Titans, got featured in the Super Friends cartoon and is now a key Justice Leaguer, is one of those that has seen his star really rise over the years. And it's not like he was a minor character. He was a key character in the Teen Titans cartoon, and the New Teen Titans comic, of course, was a major aspect of DC in the 80s, in the 90s. But I think there's the number of these properties that we see, particularly on the trade side, that are foundational characters from the respective universes versus those that have come of more recent vintage. It's incredibly lopsided back to the foundational characters.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like we said, the creators have been disincentivized from expanding on that, even if they had a surefire success for doing it. I remember watching an interview with Bruce Timm, who still seemed many, many, many years later kind of perturbed by how successful Harley Quinn had been and how little of the financial rewards for that he had gotten.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was one of the major additions to the Batman Rogues gallery since, I'd be hard-pressed to name the last one that had been a major addition to it. And one of the only ones other than Catwoman to have an ongoing series for any length of time.
Mm-hmm.
Even the Joker only had, what, 9 issues, if that, you know? So if you don't reward the creators, you've got to assume they're not going to go against, I don't want to say their best interest, but it's like, why spend the effort doing something that benefits a corporation like that if you don't get the respect and the benefit of it?
Yeah, no, I agree.
And that's one of the things where I think the creator-owned stuff is just such a different beast, because there's nothing telling a creator you can't do that or shouldn't do that other than whatever dictates they have internally.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have the same marketing arm and stuff that corporate-owned properties tend to have to back them, which is why it's, I think, a much harder thing for creator-owned property to really hit it big. And of course, I always think one of the big ironies of that is one of the creator-owned properties that hit it the biggest then became a corporate property with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah.
You know? So you gotta know when to sell and stuff like that as well. So it's one of those things that I want to see comics have more success, but I think between aspects of the direct market working against its best interest and other aspects of just comic creation kind of working against its best interests, it's an uphill battle.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, like I said before, a lot of people pulling in different directions.
Yeah, yeah. So anything else that looked particularly exciting to you on the list this time?
No, not particularly. A lot of reorder activity. But yeah, I think nothing else stood out to me. How about yourself?
There were one or two things that were clearly kind of lead-ups to some ongoing titles that were starting up. Way down at rank 438, we had Shazam Volume 1 trade paperback, some reorder activity on there, presumably gearing up for the new Shazam series that started. A little higher on the list, 335, Young Justice Volume 1 trade paperback. Again, that series just started back up. So we're seeing some of that kind of stuff. We've got a few kind of quasi-evergreen, Flashpoint, Kingdom Come, Watchmen showing on the list. A couple of epic collections, but a lot of it was nothing that immediately jumped out at me, and again, a lot of reorder activity, which is not too terribly surprising.
And especially, yeah, I think in December, getting, you know, stores just making sure they have what they need for the last of the holiday.
Yeah, well, and also the final week of the month was effectively a skip week. So you had not 4 weeks of actual releases, but more like 3.25.
Gotcha.
So there's that. If we look quickly at the price points, let's see, $19.99 was the major price point with 15.33% of the list, and 72.33% at that point or lower. And then obviously a little over a quarter of the list with 27.67% above that. If we use kind of 30% or $30 or above, then we drop to about 15.33% of the list there. So we had a couple of high ticket items, a couple at $100, a couple at $125 and such. But still, I think the market is very much favoring lower cost items.
Yeah.
Which I'm good with because I'm cheap.
Well, and I mean, it just, you know, it's just that inverted, you know, that pyramid of not everyone wants the 600 page omnibus, 1,000 page omnibus. And those things just frankly are more expensive. But, you know, I'm sure if the companies do it right, that the margin on those can be good as long as they tie their, you know, printing costs and their how many they print to the actual demand so they don't get stuck with a bunch of them. So, you know, but the other stuff is kind of like you said, a lot of the other stuff towards the lower end of the prices to get people on board this. On board the material, and obviously there's just a subset of readers like myself that just read the material this way. So this is our direct market, as they say.
Yeah, well, and I think there's a couple of things they're doing in the omnibuses that I think are just smart moves. In this case, one of them was like the Flash Silver Age omnibus. So you can get the early Silver Age stuff in a collected edition that's just a ton of material.
Mm-hmm.
I've done that with some of the Legion and... I think it was the Brave and the Bold or the Justice League. I forget which. So stuff that you just can't affordably or easily get in individual issues, I think is a good way to, you know, have the higher ticket items and stuff. But I think it's a balance of having a good coffee table edition sort of a thing or bookcase edition, I think is smart because it gives the material a little bit more, not credibility, but... cachet or something like that,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, keep the material imprint at lower cost to make it more accessible, but also have it be something that looks a little upscale for the respectability and whatnot that provides.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, but yeah, that's pretty much all I got. So, that do it?
That does it for this month.
Cool. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening. The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If they differ from your reality, please verify you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes 2 decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there's at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust and needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, lists of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50, 25, or as few as 10 items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which, as far as I know now, has not been successfully invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic books, graphic novels, and/or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists is included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside the Diamond Comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer is here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the ultimate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Math, logic, and the English language itself seem to work very differently there.